And I'd like to thank George, too, for inviting me to speak. It's always a pleasure to get to relate some of the things that we see every day to other practitioners and producers out there that really have a keen interest in our same subjects. So I think the way I'm going to start this off, I'm going to give a few words like anger, frustration, embarrassment. Those words are, I can't tell you how many times I've felt those and or heard those from my clients. When I first started doing embryo transfer in the fall of 1980 as a young 25-year-old upstart, I can remember we were superovulating clients, donors, heat detecting them and inseminating those cows. And when we would recover all unfertilized ova, it was extremely embarrassing, extremely frustrating, and it made a lot of people mad, and I didn't like that. So what I started doing, I had kind of always assumed that frozen semen is frozen semen. You know, the bull studs don't let it out if it's not good. And I'd always just thought, well, gosh, it's probably all created equal. We weren't taught in veterinary school in the late 70s anything about frozen semen evaluation. Obviously, the breeding soundness evaluations on fresh ejaculates, yes, but not on frozen semen. It's a different ball game. So, anyway, in response to those negative emotions and negative outcomes with our ET program on these donors that would produce unfertilized ova, I bought a nice microscope and I started evaluating frozen semen before we bred cows. So that led to ultimately the study of this particular topic about handling frozen semen and embryos. Okay, so I'm going to try to get through with this as quick as I can so we can get, won't be late for supper. So anyway, I want to first of all define that we do have a problem, and I do really believe that I'll convince you that we have a problem when we're through with this. And then we'll review the science of freezing cells and look at the science of thermal exposure damage. I want you to go home not just knowing don't do 1, 2, 3, or 4 or do 5, 6, 7, and 8. I want you to understand a little bit of the science behind it so that you have a better understanding and you'll have a better memory for it. We'll talk about doer management and solutions for handling these problems. And there's literally millions of frozen gametes all over the world with all different kinds of species. Millions of them. Frozen in liquid nitrogen, including non-reproductive tissues. But the problem, and somebody please tell me if anybody here has ever been enrolled in a curriculum that dealt with this topic of handling, of storing and handling frozen semen and embryos. To my knowledge, one doesn't exist. I know I didn't go through it, and I've talked with a lot of medical doctors, and I actually gave this presentation to the American Association of Tissue Banks about 5 years ago when they had their annual convention. And of course, that's, you know, human reproduction. And it was very well received. So there's many disciplines affected, veterinary, medical, laboratory. There's a lot of people that are involved in handling and using these cells. We know how to freeze cells, but do we really know how to handle them once they're frozen and stored? Do we really understand that? And how, and above all, how do we know there's actually problems associated with it? Well, I think, the American Embryo Transfer Association has a statistics and data retrieval committee that are responsible for collecting ET data annually and submitting that in the form of a manuscript that's published in their newsletter. I happened to chair that committee for 3 or 4 years in a row and prepared that report. So we have a fair amount of data that basically helps that assumption. So in 2006, there were over 600,000 total ova collected from This is beef and dairy donors. It might just be beef. I'm not sure. No, that was beef and dairy donors combined. There was a total of 600,000 total ova, meaning viable embryos, unfertilized ova, and degenerate. So a combination of all of those, and if you there's a viable embryo, a UFO, and a fertilized degenerated one, and when you add those last two together, it's about 50-50. There's a little more, couple of percent higher of viable embryos than there are. You'll have to excuse my laryngitis here. I've had a case of it. There's just a couple of percentage points higher in viable embryos than there are non-viable. But, you know, that seems like a lot of waste, doesn't it? 48% of all the total ELVA that were collected in that year were non-viable, non-usable embryos. So what could be part of that? And we know unfertilized ova don't make us any money. So there's a lot of reasons for low fertility, and some of those have been spoken about today and probably will be spoken about tomorrow. And those are all important things, but it doesn't matter what kind of technology you use, AI, embryo transfer, cloning, or, you know, looking at animals genomically selected, and it even gets more valuable. I think our technology gets more valuable as technology increases. The animals that are involved are even more important and more costly, and so is the frozen sperm and embryos. So, I think that at least we need to know how to handle them. At least we need to know how to handle them once they're frozen. So 30 years ago, I started seeing things like this, and I'm sure everybody in this audience has seen something like this. This kid is thawing out, or he's pulling out a can of semen to make sure it's the right bull that he's supposed to breed this cow to. And I remember this particular slide. I was in 1981, in the spring of 81, I'll never forget it as long as I live. I was on the farm doing embryo transfer, and this family was talking about, they were bragging, they had one straw of semen left from this bull, his last straw in the world. And it was valued at $5,000. And about 2 or 3 minutes later, I'm looking for embryos, and this 12-year-old son of theirs comes up, and he's got that straw of semen. Yeah, here it is. I wanted to show Dr. Stroud this straw of semen. And he's wiping the frost off of it so he can read all the data. He wanted to make sure I could see it all. So the question is, while we're on this slide, what's really wrong here? Is there anything wrong? And if so, what? I didn't know that until I dug into this and got with some low-temperature biologists. So in addition to just seeing guys like that and seeing incidences like that, which scared me, but I didn't really know how to react to it. Let's see if I can get my... I was just going to show you a couple of little video clips here. This is what we typically like to see when we freeze a straw frozen semen to breed a donor. But all too often, it's like this instead. The preponderance of semen that we thaw. Now, I will tell you that over the last 10 years, we all have gotten better. Everyone in the industry, I think, has gotten better because we're not culling as much as we did years ago. And then there's one more clip I won't show you, but it's totally dead sperm. And to this day, typically about a half a dozen times a year, we thaw out sperm, semen straws that are absolutely zero motility. And I know the bull stud doesn't put that out. We'll get to that in another minute. So we saw some things that made us think we had a problem, but we still needed statistical evidence. So this is a spot test. And by the way, Dr. Al Barth, who's sitting right here on the front row, you don't know how much you've influenced me, because he's got a book. It's basically our Bible. It's The Abnormal Morphology of Bovine Spermatozoa. It is a wonderful book. Unfortunately, there's none left, but it's a... No, I don't think, isn't that correct, Dr. Barth, they've all been sold? Yeah, they're not printing it anymore. An intern recently at my clinic looked one up online for $3,500. So anyway, an absolutely wonderful resource to have if you're going to ever do any frozen semen evaluation. But we came up with this little spot test, and we look at concentration, we look at motility, and we look at morphology and all the details there. And then we give it, if you look at the green bar, an overall quality rating of good, fair. And so 20 years later, after we started doing this, I had never analyzed the data, didn't have time to do it. And I thought I'd wait till the end of my career. But Dr. Neil Schrick of the University of Tennessee put some of this stuff together. And if you can see over there, the excellent, good, fair, and poor was our overall semen quality. And if you can look at the percent fertilized and the percent excellent embryos, I think he did a nice job of putting that data together. So it is meaningful, I think, to be able to evaluate this semen. So this little form addresses overall semen quality, but it really address thermal exposures. And we'll take a little bit closer look, and if we look down here on the yellow part where we've got a form there, where is it shipped from? Did the owner bring it in, or was it shipped in directly from the bull stud? And that's important because if you look at the data here, and I don't know if there's a laser pointer, not sure, but if you look at the number of shipments were a little bit weighted toward the bull stud. These are shipments of frozen semen shipped to our clinic to have donors inseminated. So if we look at the bull studs, only 2.1% was unacceptable, as opposed to what brought in by the owners was 8% unacceptable or very poor quality. So that tells you that the bull studs do a good job and the uneducated don't. Okay, I'm going to go through these. There's three slides that are just alike. Same bull, three straws in one goblet, the same goblet. And if you look in the rectangle, the square circle, the percent motile is zero for that first straw. So obviously we're not going to breed the donor with that. So the second straw jumps. The second straw in that goblet was less than 5% motility. We had some life in it. And then the final straw was greater than 30% motility. All of the same bull, the same batch code number, and the same goblet. Same cane, same goblet. So you never know what goes on out there. So I'm convinced we've got a problem. Maybe not everybody else is, but I think so. So let's go through you can understand the exposure process. Let's go through just a quick little lesson on freezing semen. So if we've got a cell here, and the blue represents water, and you see the organelles there that are very delicate, and then you've got, the plasma membrane. So I need to play the video clip here. If we expose this cell if you see the 7 degrees C there, it'll start going to 6, to 5, to 4, to 3. And once it freezes, once those intracellular water molecules freeze, they expand and crystallize, and they just destroy the organelles of the cell. Those things are extremely delicate, and they cannot withstand freezing. So to prepare cells for freezing, we've got to dehydrate them. We've got to dehydrate them, and we typically do that with glycerol or ethylene glycol. And we're talking now about embryos, and I'm going to show you a video clip about a little animation about how an embryo reacts to being exposed to glycerol. So we drop our embryo into the 10% glycerol, and the increased osmotic pressure now of the glycerol forces the intracellular water out into the extracellular space. And until that embryo is just basically has, 99% of the water essentially squeezed out of it. Okay, then the embryo undergoes equilibration. The intracellular water is moved out, and those cells want to remain at their normal size and normal state, so they take back in, or they equilibrate with the glycerol solution, and they get bigger and bigger, and basically they're now at about the size they were when we dropped them into the plate, but still a little bit of water there, still a little bit of intracellular water. So we got to get rid of that, and that's the slow cooling. That's when we put them in our embryo freezer and cool them at a half a degree centigrade per minute. So we'll show you what happens. We've got an embryo in a straw. It's laying sideways. And as you see, the crystals start coming past the embryo from left to right. What's happening here is the water in that extracellular solution is literally being removed in the form of ice. In other words, when ice freezes that water, what does that do to the concentration of glycerol? Well, it increases the concentration of glycerol so that puts more osmotic pressure on that embryo, and it kicks out those last remaining bits of water. So now we've got an embryo that's essentially water-free and ready to be dipped in liquid nitrogen, ready to be plunged in liquid nitrogen and stored. Okay, now here's Dr. Stan Lebo sent me these cryomicrophotographs, basically of what we just saw. We've got an oocyte up there, an unfertilized egg, if you will, or an oocyte that he's going to freeze. And you can see in B, the second slide there, that the ice crystals are moving across that oocyte. And then in C, the oocyte's just beginning to shrink down a little bit in response to that osmotic pressure. And in D, the water has essentially been removed in the form of ice, and now we've got that wad of cells that's basically water free and ready to be frozen, ready to be plunged into liquid nitrogen. Bovine embryos, we typically cool them to minus 30 or 35, and then we plunge them into liquid nitrogen. Okay, so now comes the rest of it. That's the freezing part. So now comes the storage part. And depending on the size of the vat and all that, depending on the make and model of the doer, all has to do with what we can and can't do with these things. So here's the take-home message right here. This is the important part. The glass transition temperature of water. Basically, minus 130 degrees Celsius is the important message here, because that's a temperature well below freezing point of water, right? 0 Celsius being a freezing point of water. So what happens is when we take a frozen sample of sperm or embryos, it doesn't matter, and we drop them below minus 130, and liquid nitrogen we know is minus 196. When they go below minus 130 and they're stored, let's say, in minus 196 in liquid, if we raise them up above minus 130 and then drop them back down below minus 130 again, then damage is done at that point. What happens is the glass transition temperature is the temperature at which really small ice crystals begin to change their shape. And when they come out of 196 above minus 130 and then they go back down below minus 130, they change from really small ice crystals, they coalesce into much larger ice crystals. And we get physical invasion of the cell membranes and the cellular organelles. So here's a really nice Dr. H.T. Merriman in 1950, and I'll brag about that, it was before I was even born. He did this experiment. And basically what you see in the upper left there is he froze water on a metallic plate it's basically kind of vitrified it, where there's really no ice crystals whatsoever. And he photographed it. There's basically very little or no ice crystals. Well, then if we move to this middle plate here, he froze the water on the plate, but then he moved that plate to minus 96 degrees Celsius for 3 minutes and then dropped it back down into liquid nitrogen. And this is what the ice crystal reformation looked like after he did that. So if we go to the next one over here, he gave it a warmer exposure, minus 85, for 30 seconds. So what he did, he froze his plate. He warmed it up to minus 85, dropped it back down into liquid nitrogen, and then he photographed it. And I'll save you the details of each one of these, but you can see as the exposure got greater or the temperature was warmer, the ice crystals got much larger. They look like rocks under a scanning electron microscope. They look like rocks. So Dr. Merry concluded that the longer the time or the higher the temperature, the worse the damage was going to be to the ice and ultimately to the cells. So we'll look at one more little animation here of a little like a frozen embryo. This is a recrystallization, if you will, in an animation where the tiny ice crystals coalesced, went together, made large ones, and they physically invaded that embryo, thus destroying it. Okay, and this is out of Dr. Barth's book that I was talking about, Abnormal Morphology. There's a little cartoon there on the left of the outer acrosomal membrane and the plasma membrane, and I think those are, in particular with sperm, are the problem areas that we're dealing with, because if we don't have the ability or the affinity for the sperm to bind to the zona and the membrane integrity, I think, is helpful, you get damaged acrosomes, enzyme leakage, and fertilization failure. So let me just real quickly ask a question here. How long would it take if we took a straw, a half cc straw of semen, took it out of liquid nitrogen, laid it on the table? How long would it take to turn into liquid, to completely thaw out? Would it be 20 seconds, 60 seconds, 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes? Anybody got a guess? I'll save you the trouble. It's 3.5 minutes. It takes 3.5 minutes for the average straw of semen to turn into liquid, and that's an important psychological point to remember, I think. Now, maybe an even more important question. If you were to take a straw of semen out of liquid nitrogen and hold it for X number of seconds, how long, and then dropped it back into liquid nitrogen, and then pulled it back out and evaluated it, how long would the exposure outside of liquid nitrogen need to be before you got zero motility? In other words, you've killed every sperm in the sample. Is it 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 30 seconds, or 60 seconds? It's about 50 to 55 seconds, depending on, you know, which bull and, you know, those kind of factors. But right in that number, until you see zero motility, it's a 50 to 60 second exposure. Okay, now, how long is the exposure before you start seeing a noticeable drop in motility? The answer is 30 seconds. Before you start seeing a noticeable, visible signs of lowered motility. And then we've got... So when I was doing this experiment, I'm thinking to myself, Well, this really isn't the most important part. What about the fertilizing capability of that sperm? Does it manifest itself just in motility? Is there some infertility associated? And I haven't run that test. I don't know the answer to that. That's going to be an expensive one to run. But I suspect that it's going to be a brief exposure, probably 10 to 12 seconds. Okay, so there's a half cc straw and a quarter cc straw. And the surface to volume ratio on the smaller quarter mil, obviously, common sense tells you that it can't take the exposure that a half cc can. You may have a minimal exposure on that half cc and only kill part of it, and the central core of that may remain unaffected. And on the quarter cc, you may not have much left. And same way with an embryo, if that embryo especially happens to be up against the edge of that straw. Okay, so here's some facts, too, I think that are important when I was doing all this work. There's temperature gradients here. So we're at 1 inch below the neck of the tank, and we're at 21.9 degrees Celsius. If we drop to 2 inches below the mouth of that tank, we're at 11.9. 3 inches at minus 23, 4 inches at minus 41, 5 inches at minus 73, and 6 inches at minus 110. What's the take-home message there? Every single one of those temperatures are warmer than minus 130. And minus 130 is we don't want to expose our samples warmer than minus 130 and then drop them back into liquid nitrogen. And it's impossible to work 6 inches to take straws out. It's virtually impossible to work 6 inches deep in the neck of a nitrogen tank. Okay, so from the time semen is collected and processed, frozen, stored, and shipped, and ultimately thawed for insemination, many opportunities exist. Many opportunities, whether it be AI technicians, ranch managers. There's a plethora of different people that are involved potentially, and it varies from operation to operation, that's going to be handling this product. So when we receive shipments, when we search for samples to thaw, when we thaw samples, preparing dry shippers, all of these opportunities are potential opportunities for thermal exposure damage. Every one of these are. And we'll look at some. So this right column over here, I think, is the most important. Who's responsible? How many people on that list know what we all know right now today? How many people have truly been taught and understand the problems with handling semen? So we're receiving shipments. This guy's going to count and make sure it's the right number of straws. That's just kind of what most people do. And that's coming out of vapor, not liquid-filled goblet. And so now he's putting what he just saw back into one of the canisters, and look what he's done to the canisters there this is typical. This is really what we see in the field. That's not an unusual finding. Okay, looking for samples to thaw. There's bull stud code numbers, and usually the name of the bull is not on the cane tab. It's a code number. Well, that AI technician's looking for, the boss told him to breed to Ferdinand. Well, he can't find it. All it is a bunch of numbers. So he's got to go through there and start looking for stuff. So, and frost on the cane tabs. If your tank gets below 3/4 full, then you're going to have frost, and you're going to want to pull those up and wipe the frost off those cane tabs, and there's other potential areas for exposure. Okay, when you thaw samples, again, it's not the sample you're thawing you're worried about. It's the mates, the canister mates that went along with it. Okay, so I think everybody gets the idea here. There's a lot of opportunities, preparing shipments, receiving shipments, taking inventory. Wow. This is a dangerous deal, and I'm going to show you how to do it so cheaply and so effectively that and nobody ever does this, but there's an easy, inexpensive way to do it. So basically what we're going to do here, these pictures are, I'm just kind of thumbing through here and giving y'all some visuals of what we typically see happen in the field. Cattle sales, they're going to sell 5 straws or they're going to sell 10. Who's dividing all that up? Who's doing that? Probably a sales manager or the ranch manager. How are they doing that? Are they doing that in ambient air, or how are they doing that? So I've found that if we keep our doers 3/4 full, the top goblet of a cane will always be full of nitrogen, liquid. And you can hold those in the neck of a doer for a couple of minutes and get away with it until that nitrogen is vaporized. Okay, so here's basically our main objective is to not let the semen get above minus 131 degrees Celsius. So the easy take-home method, well, let me talk about this a second. When we get dry shippers in, we run our thermocouple down, and if it's warmer than minus 130, we are nervous. We don't like it. We call the shipper, and we call everybody and let them know what's going on. And I think that's something that somebody probably ought to do. Don't let the top of that canister get above that frost line. You can see that frost line where that red line comes to it. It's easy to tell. Keep your samples down there and keep that top goblet full of nitrogen, not just vapor. Okay, work quickly. You've got about the eight-second rule. You got about 8 seconds in the neck of that doer if there's only vapor in that top goblet before you start seeing potential problems. It actually takes about 10 to 12 seconds. If you put a thermocouple in that straw and do the work, it takes about 10 to 12 seconds before you start seeing problems. Okay, here's the really nice take-home message. Everybody needs one of these, a little $4 ice chest that you can buy at your local hardware store. Saw it off to about 2.5 or 3 inches deep. And that one right there is still in use at our clinic, and we've probably had it 20 years. I mean, it's so cheap. You fill that up with about 1 inch of liquid nitrogen, throw your canes in there, and you can do your inventory when you receive shipments. I mean, this is so easy. It's so cheap. There's just nothing to it. And you can read through that liquid nitrogen. It's like water. You can do all your bull stud code number, your batch code number. You can get everything you need to get off that, your registration numbers. And when we get a shipment in, that's what we do. We pour a bath, and we count the straws. We make sure that and occasionally we'll find an odd straw in a cane or in a goblet that's not even that bull. So anyway, use liquid nitrogen bath all the time, basically, all the time. When you're receiving a shipment, drop it in there, look it over, and then transfer it back into your storage vessel. When you're preparing shipments, the same way. Breaking a cane means you're going to sell a couple of straws to your neighbor. And how many times have I seen a neighbor come over, bring his tank, and they'll do it in the wind outside? It's a 100-degree day, that wind's blowing, and they pull, and then it frosts up immediately, and they have to wipe the frost off of it, and by then, what kind of damage is done? So, taking inventory, this is so crucial when you take inventory, because if they sit there and hold that canister up for the duration of while that guy's counting everything in that cane, in that canister, it could be dangerous. Okay, so basically anytime you need to use a nitrogen bath, use it and have your clients do it. Okay, doer management, again, keep them 3/4 full of nitrogen. I always purchase 2 doers of the same kind instead of one. That way, if my route guy's only coming by, every 2 or 3 months, I can use that one to top my tank off that's got semen in it. Or if there's a disaster, if you've got a tank vaporizing or sweating, it's going bad, you need to put everything over into your other vessel. And if it's the same model, then you can do it canister at a time just real quickly. Okay, a little bit about biosecurity. We won't act like that, but there are some viruses and bacteria that do live happily in liquid nitrogen. They don't replicate, but they do survive. And they become mechanical vectors. They can go from one straw to the next, to the next, to the next. Okay, so solutions for handling the problems. I guess this is part of it right here. But how many farmers or ranchers or cattle breeders out there does anybody know of that basically has a program or a curriculum in place to teach their employees how to do this? I mean, it just doesn't exist. Of all the science that we've looked at today and what we'll look at tomorrow, and this is so basic. And I think we're overlooking too many things, because those times when you really have unexplained breeding failure, everything seems to be right and you scratch your head, the nutrition's good, the semen quality, you've got experienced AI technicians, you know they're thawing it properly, everything's right, everything is, and then you come up with a low conception rate. Look at this right here, because that could be a problem. The challenge is educating a lot of guys that don't think they need educating, and here's why. Here's the point. It's cowboy logic. Cowboy logic says if you've got a frozen straw of semen and it's hard, it's in a solid state, that it's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. And until I started getting involved and talking to low-temperature biologists, I didn't know any better either. I thought, well, shoot, if that thing's solid, it's still frozen, everything's okay. But that's far from the truth. We know that damage begins long before it thaws out. AI technicians mostly don't understand, or not very many people do understand these factors. So damage occurs at minus 130. Measuring losses are difficult to do. The bottom line is this. The fate of reproductive and medical patients is in the hands of numerous potential handlers. Numerous. Many, if not most, have never been formally trained. And I think that's bad on our side. Education is the key to solving the problem. More work should be done. And we actually made a training video for our clients on how to do this. I was going to make it 30 minutes, and it wound up being nearly 3 hours long to cover all of the topics. Anyway, I'll be glad to entertain a few questions. Thank you.